This is episode number 59 with data scientist at TrueMotion, Dan Schiebler. Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple. Hey guys, welcome back to the Super Data Science Podcast. And today I've got a very, very interesting episode for you. Today on the show, I had Dan Schiebler, who is a data scientist at TrueMotion. So first things first, TrueMotion is a company that develops these apps, which you can install on your phone. And you take them in with you into your car, take your phone into a car, and it'll automatically detect that you're driving. If you're the person driving or if you're in a passenger seat, it will also detect how well you're driving, if you're being distracted while driving, if you're driving too aggressively, if you're following certain safe driving techniques or not, and it will rate your progress on that. So how cool is that? All of that happens automatically. You don't even have to interact with the app. It does all of that in the background. So if you want to check out TrueMotion, then go to gotruemotion.com/app. You can download it there completely for free and test it out for yourself. And today we will understand how all of this works, thanks to Dan, who is one of the brains behind this whole operation, who does the data science of this app, and he'll be on the show today. So Dan came on and shared a lot of insights about how sensor data from your phone is actually can be collected and analyzed, and how data science can be applied to that to generate valuable insights. So you'll definitely find out more about that. We'll talk about Dan's background as well and how he got into data science and how he ended up working in this amazing and exciting space. And probably one of the coolest parts about this podcast, it is that we're discussing very applied things. So you will actually see how data science is used in action, how data science enables this completely new industry, this completely new way of thinking about driving, and how data science changes lives. So it's a very, very important thing to be able to actually see the value that data science can bring. And that's exactly what Dan shared with us today. So without further ado, I bring to you Dan Schiebler of TrueMotion. Welcome everybody to the Super Data Science Podcast. Today I've got a super exciting guest, Dan Schiebler. We met with Dan at the ODSC conference, and he was giving a very exciting talk on applied machine learning. So I'm super excited to have Dan on board. Welcome to the show, Dan. How are you going today?
Doing great. Really happy to be here.
And where are you calling in from?
Calling in from Boston, Massachusetts.
Oh, fantastic. That's exactly where the conference was and where I attended your talk. And so how's the weather in Boston right now?
Terrible, like always.
It's like always like that, isn't it? Like when I was there, it was like raining for 5 days.
So sometimes it clears up and you appreciate it so much more.
Mm. Have you been to London by any chance?
Once or twice, I have.
So how does the weather compare in Boston to London?
Remarkably similar. They called it New England for a reason.
Oh, that's the reason. I was like, why do they call that part of the US New England? It's like so confusing. And how does it work? Tell me, like, before like we jump into politics, how does it work with like football teams? Like, you only have one? You only have a New England team, or you have several?
No, there are several. There's the New England Patriots is the main football team in New England. I'm actually not sure if there's any other New England football team. The Patriots are pretty dominant, and so
yeah, good. Yeah, I've definitely heard of the Patriots. Okay. So getting a bit sidetracked. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Your talk was very inspiring, like one of the most practical talks. And I just couldn't wait to get you on here to share with the world about how like data science and machine learning can really be used in the real world. So how about we start with where you work? What's the company called where you work, and what do you do there?
So I work at TrueMotion. we develop smartphone apps that can track how good of a driver you are. And we do this in order to make driving safer. We work with some of the largest insurance companies in the world in order to give people discounts on their car insurance and incentivize safe driving. My job is developing machine learning algorithms that operate on smartphone sensor data in order to track how good of a driver you are, identify dangerous driving behaviors, and suggest ways that you can improve your driving.
That's so cool. And is this, because like I've heard of this, it's not a big thing in Australia where I am, or maybe it is a thing, but I don't know if people use it or not at all. But is it like compulsory in the US, or people to sign up to it voluntarily?
It's not. It's actually been a kind of growing for the past 10 or 15 years. There have been programs in place where you would install custom hardware in your car. Mm. And it's sort of a pay-as-you-go insurance, where if you drive more and you drive less safely, then your car insurance will go up. And if you drive more safely or drive less, your car insurance will go down.
Mm.
And so it helps people who feel that they shouldn't be getting charged as much as other people get discounts. And we're sort of bringing it to the masses by moving the technology off of customized hardware you have to install in your vehicle to just an app that you can download on your phone. It's live in about half of the US states at the moment.
Wow.
And it's growing.
That's really cool. And I just wanted to reiterate that for people listening, it's like I've heard of the custom hardware install, but this is so cool. This is just like on your phone. You just put in your phone. And of course, there's like lots of complications with that. And we'll get into those in a second. So when you download this app, does a person have to register with your company, or does their insurance company already have to support your app?
So we have a number of different programs that we offer. There's some programs we go directly through insurance companies, where when somebody signs up on an insurance company, they would download the insurance company's app, which would have our software and our algorithms running on it. We also offer some of our own commercial apps. We have TrueMotion Family and Mojo, which are different applications that have the same algorithms and same idea. One is for parents and teens to be able to learn how to become safer drivers together. That's TrueMotion Family. And Mojo is an app for people to become rewarded from driving without being distracted. You accumulate points based off of how many distraction-free miles of driving you have. And when you get enough points, you're eligible to win Amazon gift cards.
Oh, that's so cool. That's like your company's contribution back to the community, right?
Exactly.
That's awesome. And what is, this is the next question I had. What is defined as distractionless driving, and what is safe driving in general, according to your definitions?
So there's, again, this is a sort of application specific question. So in terms of distraction, we classify distraction in we really focus on distraction as being interactions with your cell phone. And there's a variety of different types of interactions that people have with their cell phones while they're driving, some of which are more or less dangerous. There have been a number of longitudinal studies that have been performed on thousands of drivers with cameras in people's cars that have really broken down what types of distraction actually increases people's risks of getting into accidents, but just tracking what types of distractions people doing and did they get into accidents. And really the bottom line is the type of tapping on the screen and swiping and sending text messages and active interaction with your cell phone is very dangerous.
Yep.
Whereas using a GPS app or listening to music with your cell phone, that's relatively safe. From the perspective of the car itself and the other safe and dangerous driving things that people do, one really strong indicator actually of whether somebody is driving safely is their braking habits. When somebody brakes really hard, that's usually indicative that they were driving at a speed that is above that of those around them, or that they were driving aggressively and sort of cutting in and out of lanes and such, trying to get ahead, and then had to slam on the brakes for one reason or another.
Yep, I totally agree. I'm sure all of us have been in situations where there's like a driver in front of us braking very hard in like on a highway or something, and then you have to brake very hard as well because of that person, and or somebody's like cutting in front of you. It's definitely see where that is coming from. And so your talk was titled something along the lines of the number of sensors in your in your phone or the variety of sensors. So can you correct me on the title? And let's talk a bit about that. How many sensors exist in a modern phone?
The title of the talk was the power and pains of sensor data. Because, like you're alluding to, there are a very wide number of sensors that are in your phone and in other devices that you would surround yourself with every day. I don't know if I have a number right off the top of my head, maybe around 10 to 15 different useful sensors that would provide rich time series data that you could use just from your cell phone.
Gotcha. And give us a couple of examples. I'll start with the ones that everybody knows, like a GPS and what else? Like a temperature gauge and maybe like a barometer. Like those are kind of first ones that spring to mind. What else do you have in mind for a phone?
So probably the three of the ones that we think about the most, in addition to the ones you've mentioned, would be the accelerometer, the gyroscope, and the magnetometer, which all sort of fall into the general set of the IMU, which can track the position of the phone and the sorts of forces that are currently acting on the phone. And that's really useful for determining where the phone is, what the phone is doing, recognizing people's activity, and from our perspective, recognizing vehicle activity.
So let's go through a couple of those. So you said, temperature, understand, GPS, understand. What is GPS in your phone? It's like a little microchip, right?
Yeah, it communicates with satellites. You know, it uses the Doppler effect to get an estimate of your current position and an estimate of your speed. The speed estimate from the GPS is more reliable than the position estimate because the signal that's being measured directly is the speed and the position sort of being computed from that.
That's cool. Then barometer tells you how high you are or how uphill or downhill you are. Is that right?
Yeah, the barometer is the pressure sensor. So it can tell the air pressure around you, which you can use as a proxy for altitude because when you higher you go up, the lower the air pressure is around you. And you can use the barometer for other pretty cool things. Like you can see on the barometer signal when someone opens up a window in their car or something like that.
Yeah, the pressure in the car changes, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. How does the accelerometer work? I'm really curious about that one.
So the accelerometer measures force and acceleration. Different accelerometers work in different ways. I believe the one in the cell phone works with the capacitor. It's got three axes. So really it's three accelerometers that are fixed in the X, Y, and Z axes of the phone. And when force is exerted on the phone, it creates a spike in capacitance that generates voltage signals that the phone then can interpret as accelerations along the different axes.
Okay, that's really cool. And okay, so the next one is gyroscope. What does that one tell us?
So the gyroscope picks out rotational acceleration. So really probably the best way to think about the gyroscope and the accelerometer is that the accelerometer pulls out linear accelerations and the gyroscope pulls out rotational accelerations.
Okay.
And that would be like turning along the axes of the phone. If you think of kind of spinning your phone in your hand or, you know, even spinning it on the table, those are the sorts of things that the gyroscope would pick up.
Okay, gotcha. And that would be helpful for you to understand if somebody's like picked up their phone or not.
Yeah, it's also helpful for understanding what the orientation of the phone is and how the orientation is changing in space.
Gotcha. And we'll get to that in a second. And let's talk about the magnetometer. What do you use that for?
So magnetometer is like the sort of canonical use of it is for a compass. It picks up the magnetic fields and lets you orient the phone with respect to the Earth. And when you integrate the magnetometer with the accelerometer and the gyroscope, it gives you a third-party reference for the phone's position. With just the accelerometer and the gyroscope, if you're trying to track how the phone changes position over time, you experience this sort of drift that occurs as errors accumulate and you lose track of where the phone is exactly. But if you have a third external reference to the outside world, which actually could be the GPS or the magnetometer, depending on your application, you can get a better sense of absolute location and minimize drift. Although in practice, being able to determine phone's position and see long-term position changes just using IMU is really difficult.
Gotcha, yeah. Thanks for that overview. And the reason, like, people who are listening to this podcast, you might be wondering, like, why I asked all these questions. The reason I asked is because, as with any data science challenge, it's important to understand what input data you have. Well, first of all, of course, it's very interesting that you have these six and many more very powerful sensors in your phone, which you probably didn't even know about. But at the same time, it's very important to know what input data you have to deal with when you're solving a data science challenge, especially something real world like this. So Dan, tell us more now. Now that we know what data you have, what do you do with this data to come up with those insights that we're talking about to tell if a person's driving safe or they're driving risky?
Really, there's a wide range of different algorithms that we would want to do and different sorts of pre-processing that it's useful to operate on for each of these algorithms. I think a good example would be a type of pre-processing that we want to use for all of our different algorithms, which would be pulling out the gravitational acceleration of the phone. So what this means is the accelerometer lets you see what the linear accelerations on the phone are, but understanding which of those accelerations are from gravity and which of those accelerations are from other sources lets you find exactly what is the orientation of the phones, which can tell you if the phone's in a pocket, if the phone's in somebody's hand, if the phone's in a mount, if the phone's flat on a surface. And that gives us a lot of insight into what the phone is doing at a particular point in time. And in order to do that, we would use a sensor fusion algorithm. We'd use the one typical one is the Kalman filter to fuse the inputs from the gyroscope and the accelerometer in order to pull out those gravitational accelerations and get an estimate of the phone's position based on that.
Okay, gotcha. So basically, if my phone's in my pocket in the car, or if it's in the car in the car door, or if it's on the seat next to me, or if it's in my hand, you can tell that through this sensor fusion approach that you're taking to these sensors.
Yeah, exactly. And once we have that signal, it becomes way easier to tell all the other things we want to tell, like when a car is doing a turn, or pull out when someone's got the phone in their hand, because we've got this more reliable derived signal from those sensors. This is a pattern that pops up a lot in all of this sensor processing, where you have the raw signal, and then it's usually difficult to build a machine learning algorithm that operates directly on that. But there's this like 100 years of signal processing algorithms and mathematics that have been developed that it's really useful to form these pre-processed signals from your raw signals before using them in your machine learning algorithms.
Understand. And so, like, I just wanted to also highlight how important this is. And for me, this was one of the key points in your talk, like really revelational, that you cannot just use the sensor data as it is. You have to understand a very important thing, and how the phone is oriented in the car. So to understand which sensor corresponds to braking, which sensor corresponds to centrifugal force when you're going around a corner, and those things. So you have to kind of prepare the playing field in order to understand these things. And that was really cool that you guys have come up with a way to do that effectively, and then actually use the data in the correct meaning that it is conveying. And the next question is then, how, once you know all these things, and once you've you know how the phone's oriented, and you can derive like these metrics from it, what kind of machine learning algorithms do you apply to that data?
So one pretty cool thing, I think before talking about the machine learning algorithm, maybe just flesh out which problem we're trying to solve.
Sure.
So one problem that pops up a lot for us is determining what sort of vehicle somebody is in at a point in time, given the sensors that we're seeing. Because if we see that somebody is experiencing a whole bunch of bumps on their phone, and it looks like they're speeding up and slowing down and all of that, we don't want to automatically jump to the conclusion that this person's a bad driver just because they were in a bus and that bus was driving somewhere and the bus driver was terrible. and even more difficult would be if someone's on a bicycle. The sensors that from a bicycle, if we thought it was a car, we might think, wow, this guy's a really terrible driver. Look at how much the phone's moving all over the place.
And how slow he's going, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But if we, it's useful for us to build algorithms that could identify mode of transit. And even harder would be driver identification, determining whether somebody's a driver or a passenger in a car.
Oh, wow. That's right. That was a big part of your talk. How do you do that? How do you decide if a person's a driver or if it's a passenger in the car?
So we've got a whole ensemble of different algorithms to do that. One that uses the sensor data pre-processing we were talking about is the exit window method, which is an algorithm that we use for determining the moment that someone exits the car, and given that, which side of the car they exited on. In the US, people drive on the left side of the car. So if you're exiting from the left door, then you're more likely to be the driver. And if you're exiting from the right door, you're more likely to be the passenger. It's not always the case, because sometimes people will sit in the back left seat, but it's a pretty strong signal. And if we can get that estimate of gravitational acceleration on the phone and get an estimate of the orientation of the phone, we can use the gyroscope to tell which side of the car the person exited from.
Wow, that is so cool. That's just mind-blowing. Like, people get out of cars every day. They don't even know that there's data that is being collected about that. And yep. not necessarily everybody has your app for now, but still, it's like that can be determined from the data on your phone. That's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so now that we know the one of the problems, is there any other problems that you're trying to determine? So you're trying to determine what type of vehicle, whether it's like a bus or a car or if, mm-hmm. a bicycle, if it's a driver or a passenger. You're also, then you're trying to understand also if it's a passenger or a driver, if it's in a car. Are there any other complications that you have to solve before you get to the data processing part?
Well, one pretty key problem is actually just detecting a trip, detecting when is somebody going fast enough or moving in a way that we would think, oh, this person has begun a trip, which would be like they've started driving or biking or taking a bus or something like that. I mean, one naive way we could do that would be, let's just constantly ping their GPS at a full power. And if we think that they're moving fast enough for a consistent amount of time, then we'll say, okay, this person's in a trip. Let's run all our mode of transit and driver identification algorithms on it and determine what's going on. But this burns a lot of battery. So we have to, solving this problem is actually a little bit more difficult than just relying on the GPS to throttle the person's phone and tell us exactly what's going on. So we can use cell phone towers and Wi-Fi signals to use the triangulate somebody's position and determine whether or not they're moving. If the closest cell phone tower to somebody is changing at a certain pace, such that the cell phone signal from one tower decreases and another one increases. And the same thing with Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi signals from certain Wi-Fis start changing at a sort of cyclical pattern. That's usually indicative of motion, especially at a particular speed. And when you see that signal, then you can decide, oh, let's turn up the GPS. And so processing and understanding those signals from those sensors is a tough problem in and of itself.
That is another really cool thing. So it's reminds me of what is it called? Reminds me of, I think it was Mission Impossible. It was like, what's that movie with Bruce Willis? They have like a series of those movies.
Which one? Fast and Furious?
No, Bruce Willis.
No, that's Die Hard. Maybe?
Yeah, Die Hard. And then like Die Hard 3 or 4, where they're like in this big van and they're traveling across the US and they're like stopping the whole government from that van, like stopping all the traffic lights and stuff like that. Nobody knows where they are. And then the guys, they're like, we can triangulate them. We can find out where they are through mm-hmm. triangulation. And that's like, oh, that's what Dan does. Okay, got it.
Exactly. Every day, just like that.
That is so cool. Okay.
You got a set of machine guns in
there. that's not a thing in Boston, right? That's in Massachusetts. That's more like Texas. Instead of machine guns at home.
Yeah, less popular here.
Okay. All right, gotcha. So we've got three issues that we found out now. So trip, whether a person's on a trip or not, what type of transit, and whether they're not or not they're a driver. All right, now can we get to the algorithms, or is there more challenges that you have to solve before you get there?
Well, there's always more challenges, but I think that's a pretty good overview.
All right, cool. So let's get to the algorithms. What type of machine learning approaches do you take to get the insights that you're after from this data?
So if we're trying to determine how good of a driver somebody is, just once we've sort of identified, all right, this person's on a trip, let's run our machine learning algorithms on them to pull out events. Usually the way that we think about driving is in terms of discrete events. When somebody commits a hard braking event or commits a distracted driving event, then we have that ding them. And then we'll aggregate those events and run a different algorithm on the aggregated events to get an estimate of risk. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a hierarchical pattern rather than an end-to-end model that runs directly on the sensors. So to pull out the events, that's the situation when we would be running a little bit more complex machine learning algorithms that operate directly on the sensor data. So for example, for pulling out distracted driving events, we would look at the signal and segment the signal into different short segments to try to estimate the moment when somebody begins a distracted driving event, when they pick up their phone or when they first unlock the screen. So we'll train either, we have actually a few different models for different situations, whether the algorithm is running on the back end or running on the phone. Some are random forests and some are neural networks that would operate directly on the sensor data in order to pull out those events. And once that model gets run on the trip, we would look at how the events that are predicted sort of look over time when we pass another model over them that reasons about the time series nature of the data. We have a hidden Markov model that would reason about, well, if this person was using their phone at this point, maybe they'd be more likely to use this type of phone usage here, or that type of phone usage there. The models would want to produce different types of outputs in kind of a multi-class classification sense for whether the phone's in the person's hand and they're swiping, or in the person's hand and they're tapping, or in the case of somebody on a phone call or something like that. That's, I think, basically the algorithm overview for distracted driving case.
Okay, gotcha. So you have two separate types of parts of your analysis. First of all, you apply some algorithms like random forest or a neural network directly on the sensor data to understand, to like pull out those points in time where you have distracted driving events. And then, as I understood, you take those individual distracted, like potentially distracted driving events, and you put them into a time series, and then you use a hidden Markov model on top of them to analyze what type of distracted driving event that could have, behavior that could have been.
Yeah, exactly. And we interject at both points in the model, we interject a bit of other information that comes through. The operating system of the phones give us some information on whether the screen was currently on or whether the person was in the process of a phone call or placed a phone call. And those would help to tune the behavioral modeling, hidden Markov model aspect of the algorithm and based on the phone's inputs. And what's really key is, and a key problem that appears there is the different types of phones, the Android and iOS and the 10,000 different types of Android phones, give signals like that in very different situations and with different amounts of accuracy. The motion sensor signals are also different amounts of accuracy for those different types of phones. So we have to develop all of our algorithms in a way such that they produce outputs that are really consistent between the different kinds of inputs that get provided by the different types of devices.
Okay. Yeah, and so you mentioned something around the legal side of things, around that you have to make sure that your software works the same way on all the phones, regardless of their, like, whether they're expensive, whether they're cheap, because you cannot discriminate against any people that might be using a software. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So that's an important and probably a difficult issue for you to solve, since, you know, phones that are less expensive, they probably have less sensors. Is that what you find?
Absolutely. It becomes at some points we need to decide that there's certain phones we're just not going to support if we don't think that we're going to be able to grade people in a totally safe fashion. For example, some types of Android phones don't have gyroscopes. And if all of our algorithms are developed with really relying on gyroscopes, and there's really certain things you can only do if you have gyroscope information, you really can't include somebody in the program if they don't have a phone that has a gyroscope. But beyond that, it really requires just an analysis of all of the different sources of data and doing sort of distribution analyses to make sure that the distribution of judgments for people, both from the raw sensor data, the pre-processed sensor data, and the responses that we produce, are consistent between the different types of devices. And we could use different kinds of distribution analyses methods like KL divergence and things like that to get those estimates.
Good. That sounds really cool. And before we proceed, so that was the distracted driver approach for you, how you solve that. And before we proceed to the safe driver, just in a nutshell, very quickly, can you tell us what a hidden Markov model is?
A hidden Markov model is an algorithm for modeling time series based on the theory that at each time step, there's some output that we've observed, but the system was in this hidden state that we didn't observe. And at each time step, the state progresses, this hidden state progresses. That hidden state might be, in this case, the phone is in the person's hand. The phone is down. The person is on a call. And when you're in a different state, you have a different probability of emitting different visible signals, which could be the kinds of vibrations of the phone that would be indicative of these different situations. And you also have different probabilities of transitioning to the other states. So when you suspect that your data at each point in time is reliant and will change based on what sort of state somebody is in, and that their state transitions, one state is less likely to follow, state B is more likely to follow state A than follow state B, C or something like that, a hidden Markov model is a good choice. It makes some pretty strong assumptions. It makes the Markov assumptions, which we don't need to get into, but it's a pretty good model for those types of situations.
Gotcha. Thank you very much for that overview. Okay, so maybe now let's proceed to the safe driver algorithm. How do you determine if somebody's a safe driver or not? Machine learning algorithms do you use for that?
One type of signal that's pretty reliable for picking out safe driving is the hard braking signal, which would be just pulling out the moments when someone slams on the brakes. And we've got a few different models for that, actually, that we use in different situations. In fact, this is actually a sort of unintuitive, the GPS signal, the speed signal for the GPS is good enough that if we're simply trying to get an estimate of the moments when somebody brakes, if you just look at how the speed changes over time and use sort of advanced signal processing methods to get a good stable estimate of the derivative of the speed, you can pull out the braking periods without even using a machine learning model. Just when you have that signal, it takes a lot more of the signal processing side in order to do that, though. The tough machine learning parts come in when you want to do the same thing without the GPS. Because as we mentioned, the GPS really burns your battery. And if you're trying to have the whole thing operate in a lightweight fashion where you don't have GPS throttling you, and you want to pull out the brakes on the accelerometer, the accelerometer signal is a little bit too noisy to do it in a really simple rule-based fashion. So using machine learning algorithms that are pretty similar, actually, with the segmenting a signal, and you got to do a whole bunch of pre-processing first, but then segmenting the signal and putting on an algorithm on top of that works pretty well.
Gotcha. And so, and by this point, you already, because you know the orientation of the phone, and correct me if I'm wrong, but because you know the orientation of the phone, you can separate what is a braking signal and what is a centrifugal force signal, meaning that the person is going around the corner. Is that right?
We can do that, but it's actually pretty difficult to get that signal separation. Just by using the gyroscope and the accelerometer, let's we could take a step back and sort of define this problem in a more complete way. The phone has three axes of acceleration, and the car has three axes of acceleration as well. For the phone, it's the X, Y, and Z axes. For the car, it's the longitudinal axis, which is front to back, lateral axis, which is side to side, and vertical axis, which is up and down. And if we want to rotate the phone into the car's reference frame, we need to find a rotation matrix that would do that. So just by looking at the accelerometer and the gyroscope and using the Kalman filter, we can resolve two of those degrees of freedom. We can rotate the phone so that it's aligned with gravity, yep. But we still don't know the angle between the phone screen and the front of the car. We have to use a different method to pull that out. And that's the hard part. To do that, we use principal component analysis, actually, a PCA. So as the car drives, there's the axes of acceleration that the car experiences will be longitudinal when the car speeds up or brakes, and lateral when the car takes a turn because of the centripetal force. So since those are the axes of acceleration by which the car experiences most acceleration, those are the axes of maximal variance that the phone would experience acceleration on. So when we perform PCA on the motion sensor readings of the phone, after we've aligned it with gravity, that will then give us that angle that we need to rotate the phone so that it's aligned with the car. And then we can pull out the brakes and turns and such.
Oh, okay, that's so cool. That's such a cool approach to that. Yeah, that's very interesting. And now I can see how that works. And from that, you can tell when the person's is braking or accelerating too fast. And there you go. You have your result that you were after. Mm-hmm. That's so cool. Well, thanks so much for the overview. It's really great to see how interesting this work is and what you're up to in the space of true motion. I think this was really invaluable as a real practical application of data science and machine learning. And what I would like to get into now is kind of move away a bit from the algorithms themselves and talk about your background, because a lot of people will be wondering, how on earth does somebody get a job that interesting? Is a job about, that actually makes such a huge impact and is so much fun. So tell us a bit about you. Like according to your LinkedIn, you went to Brown University, but there you studied something completely different. You studied neuroscience and also computer science. So how did that go and where did that take you?
I started at Brown just studying neuroscience, actually, and pretty quickly got interested in the more computational side of neuroscience when I started doing some pretty cool neuroscience research on neurosurgery patients that would determine how people make decisions and drilling into the actually sensor data. Understanding from microelectrode recordings in people's brains how different voltages fluctuate when people make different kinds of decisions and pulling out those sorts of signals. So really my first experience with data science was through a neuroscience lens, and a pretty similar in terms of the tools used and the techniques needed to what I'm doing right now. And I transitioned from that into a more computer science and computational focus. I really just loved how rich and exciting the field of computer science was. And I loved the logic and mathematics part of it as well. And I think data science kind of came naturally from that. I originally came into computer science from a sort of data science perspective. And that was the kind of focus that I had with really mathematics and data science.
Okay, that's really cool. And so then after your degree, did you go straight to TrueMotion or did you, looks like you did some work at Brown University first?
I did. I actually also worked for a short period of time at MathWorks.
Oh, okay.
Which makes MATLAB. but I met one of the guys from TrueMotion, and he told me about it, and I just really couldn't resist. It sounded too exciting and too awesome.
That's so cool. That's so cool. And yeah, so this work at TrueMotion, like, by the sounds of, you know, how you talk about it, it really excites you. Does it inspire you that you're actually making a difference to people's lives and help them, that you're helping them achieve, you know, safer driving and better insurance policies?
Yeah, I mean, it's cool to me that we can sort of build something and it will immediately be in the hands and changing the lives of so many different people. We receive a huge amount of feedback from different people. It's a very tight feedback loop on the algorithms I produce, and it's really interesting, difficult problems. And it's nice to know that the things that I do every day can help people become safer and help people save money.
It's always inspiring, I think, when you know, you have instant, or not instant, like very quick, you can see the results of your work very quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and can you, like, in terms of the work that you do at TrueMotion, I know that a lot of it is private information to the company, but is there a win that you recently had, something that you achieved and that you're really proud of, something that you can share with us?
I don't know if I'd classify this as a win or something that we're really excited about in general, that it's, I would consider it a win.
Okay, sounds good.
We're building, we just finished building out our behavior modification platform, where we can run sort of really intense statistical analyses on people's behavior change in real time and quickly change the experience that people are experiencing, as such that we can measure their behavior change in a statistically rigorous fashion on really short timescales. So a lot of statistical analyses for people's behavior and people's experience, it's really easy to screw them up and sort of stop tests early, or, you know, put more people into a test after you've already checked its results and get p-values that you come out with that you really can't trust. Yep. And we put a lot of time and thinking into building this model that we've kind of spent a lot of time whiteboarding things out and running simulations and such to make it statistically rigorous. And we've got something that's got a pretty fast feedback loop that's changing people's behaviors in a way that we can analyze it statistically rigorously, and pretty excited about that.
That's awesome. But what do you mean by when you say you're changing people's behaviors? Like, is your app telling them what to do and how to behave?
Yeah, so the problem of behavior change is pretty challenging with people's driving, because people often perceive themselves as good drivers, and we can give you a score afterwards and say, oh, you had, you know, 3 hard braking events, and that means your score is terrible, or something like that. And that will change people's behavior, but not in a really good targeted fashion. So we're experimenting with lots of different regimes of push notifications, different presentations of the app, real-time alerts as well, with, like, the phone might ding you when you pick it up, or heartbreak or something like that, in different kinds of patterns. Really, the kinds of user experience variations that most applications will have. And pretty much every company that makes apps or websites or something like that experiments with this at some point in order to change people's behavior for one way or another. But for us, it's a pretty high stakes game. If we change people's behavior, we reduce car crashes. So we're pretty excited about it.
That's really cool. Love it. Love that example. Okay, so the next one is, I don't know, maybe you've already covered this in what we discussed previously, but still, I'm going to ask this anyway. What is your one most favorite thing about being a data scientist?
I think it's the way that data science changes really quickly. Like the fact that right now this is sort of the very early days of data science and machine learning, really, in general. And I think that there's this huge set of problems that have been sort of present that people have been aware of for a very long time. And people have been trying to figure out ways to solve them and haven't really been able to for a while. But just recently, people people have been designing algorithms that use large amounts of data in order to solve problems that have been thought of as nearly impossible for almost a century. And that's really exciting, that we're kind of at this turning point in computational problem solving. And the way that these problems are being solved is with data science and with machine learning. So being a part of that, being a part of this revolution in computational power is really exciting.
That's so cool. But I totally agree with that. And the other thing to that is that the other aspect is that it's changing in so many different areas and so many different domains at the same time. And on that, like in medicine, in cars, in rockets, in mining, in just social networks, everywhere. And on that, I wanted to ask you, do you ever feel that you're missing out? Do you ever feel that, yes, you're like one of the top people driving the change in people's behavior in driving and how they're, you know, how to measure if they're driving safe or being distracted, which is a huge thing and has a huge impact. But at the same time, do you ever feel that, I wish I knew more about what's going on in the space of, I don't know, data science and medicine, or how data science is used in social networks? Do you ever get that feeling, or are you kind of like, are you set in what you're doing and you're just confident in that you're happy and you're doing what you're passionate about?
Well, I'd say really that, I mean, this is the information age, right? There's really, when I get curious about how data science is moving in another field, it's pretty easy for me to, you know, look up, read some research papers on what's going on elsewhere and dive into it and work on it as much as I can. And in fact, I've actually got a pretty good example. I've been interested in really the cutting edge of neural network models, the convolutional neural network models for image understanding, and their relationship to neuroscience. And there's a professor at Brown University who's done a lot of research on this, Tomas Serre. And so I contacted him, and I've been doing research with him in my spare time outside of TrueMotion, sort of working with him and some of his postdocs and grad students on some of the papers that they've been working on. It's been really cool being part of a cutting edge field of deep learning and data science that's totally orthogonal to the sort of stuff I do at TrueMotion. So I'd say that there's opportunities to be involved in any of the kinds of problems that I'm really interested in.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad you said that a lot of people out there, they kind of think that you really need to get into get a job and get into the industry. And that is correct. You do need to get a job eventually. Mm-hmm. But there's so many opportunities, just like you gave this example. It's such a great example that you're interested in a space of data science, convolutional neural networks. So, you know, you have spare time. You went and found a leading researcher in that field, and now you're doing some work with him. That is such an inspiring example. I really hope people listening to this podcast will get inspired by that and get some ideas from that on how they can pursue something that they're passionate about, even if they're not necessarily doing work in that space right now. Okay, so that's really cool. And this all leads up to a question I'm really eager to ask you. From what you see about data science, from the work you do at TrueMotion, from the research that you do, from all these other interests that you have in data science and machine learning and neural networks and so on, where do you think the field of data science is going? And what do you think our listeners should prepare for to be ready for the future that's coming?
So I think data science is going in a lot of different directions, but one thing that's really underlying all of it is this democratization of data science, which is just data science becoming easier for people to do, easier for people to learn, easier for people to do really powerful, really cool stuff with cutting-edge technologies without learning a humongous amount about all of the underlying math and underlying tech. And just being able to sort of jump in and do stuff at an easier level. And the reason why I think this, and in addition to the huge number of research papers and automated data science and all of that that's being propagated, is if you think about like programming computers, when computers first came out and when people first started programming computers, it was really hard. You had to use punch cards.
Yeah.
Then people were writing in assembly. I mean, imagine if people had to write in assembly, developed higher level languages on top of that, it'd be really impossible to build the sorts of incredible things that people can build today. And it's really been possible because people have sort of put this extra layers on top of it that hide the nitty-gritty details and let people kind of move building blocks around in an easier to understand fashion so that they can bring their own expertise and own knowledge to build something really incredible, because nobody can understand every single part of something really complicated. We work by standing on the shoulders of other people's achievements. And I think that data science is going to work like that. I think as data science becomes easier, it'll be easier for people like doctors or physicists or such that have incredibly deep knowledge in their fields to use the tools of data science in a way that fits very nicely into the sort of work that they've been doing already. And I don't think that this necessarily means that it's not useful for people to learn about all the nitty-gritty details of data science. Just like any computer scientist can really benefit from understanding the fundamentals of a computer, I think that any data scientist can really benefit from understanding the mathematics underlying data science techniques. But I think that that's something that we should be ready for, is a lot of people coming into data science who don't have really firm mathematical backgrounds, and for data science becoming easier for people to use and easier for people to do.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. That's a very refreshing view on what is going on, because we've had different opinions on the podcast. We've had people say that automation is going to completely drive data science, like the human aspect of data science, away. We've had other people with other opinions. Your opinion is very, very powerful and inspiring as well, because that's what I think also, and that's how we structure our courses, in the sense that, just as an example, that we kind of try to avoid the complex mathematics and like focus on the intuition and the practical side, because as you say, you don't really need to go into the nitty-gritty of what's going on in that algorithm to be able to understand, you know, like on an intuitive level how it works, and also be able to apply it in practice. And that's the essential part, what matters. It's like, let's say, driving a car. We've spoken about cars quite a lot, mm-hmm. but it's like driving a car. You kind of know what a car does when you accelerate and when you brake and things like that. And you know what approximately is going on inside the car, and you know how to use it. You know how to apply that car to get you from A to B, or to drive somebody else and things like that. You don't necessarily have to be a car mechanic and get into the nuts and bolts and understand every single thing that's going on in the car in order to be able to use it effectively. And I think that's that kind of like reiterates your point about data science, that is exactly where the world's going, because this field is growing so rapidly, and people and companies and the world just needs more skilled people who can apply data science, and that creates a huge world of potential and opportunity for those who want to break into this field.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So thanks so much for sharing that and for coming on the show. Where, if our listeners want to contact you or find you or follow your career and see what else you're going to get up to in the future, where is the best way to connect with you?
So I have a website that's danschiebler.com. That's mm-hmm. that should have my contact info on it, and I post some of the interesting things that I'm thinking about and working on there. My email address is danschiebler@gmail.com or dan@gotruemotion.com. And I respond to emails from people who have questions if anybody's interested in some of the stuff that I'm working on.
It's definitely great that you've shared this. You're happy to respond to questions. And is it okay for people to connect with you on LinkedIn?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. And one more question I have for you. What is your one favorite book that you can recommend to our listeners so that they can become better data scientists?
So it's not really a book. It's a collection of online course notes that sort of form a textbook. It's Andrew Ng's CS229 course that he teaches at Stanford. The course notes of the course are all online. If you just Google CS229, is the first thing that comes up. And it's really an incredible dive into some of the theory behind machine learning and data science with incredibly intuitive descriptions. So for somebody who wants to get a little bit deeper in there and feels relatively comfortable with multivariable calculus and linear algebra and such, it's the tool that I used to really introduce myself to the cutting edge in the field. And I find myself going back to it again and again to refresh on different things. I highly recommend it.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, thank you so much again. So that is Andrew Ng, course notes for C229. And thank you very much, Dan, for coming on the show, taking out some time of your Sunday evening to share all of these insights. I'm sure a lot of people will find them very useful.
No problem. It's great being here. Thank you for having me.
So there you have it. That was Dan Schiebler from TrueMotion. And I hope you enjoyed today's podcast and learned quite a lot of new things. And of course, there were so many valuable things that Dan shared with us. For instance, all of the sensory data from smartphones, how it's collected and processed, how they analyze the orientation of the phone. That was so interesting. And how they apply data science to extract valuable insights about people's driving. Also, it was very interesting to learn about Dan's background. But probably for me, the one most fascinating thing and the most inspiring thing from this podcast was how Dan, in his spare time, researches other areas of data science that he has interest in. Like, he was talking about how he does research in the space of convolutional neural networks just in his spare time, just because he is very interested in that field. And that is a huge testament to human ambition. If you really want to get into data science, if you really want to excel at something, then you don't have to just wait until you get a job, or you don't have to be just only learn about the things that you're doing at your job. You can, as Dan shows with his example, you can be investigating and learning about completely different fields of data science if you have the passion and drive to do so. So hopefully that inspired you as much as it inspired me. And remember to hit up Dan and connect with him on LinkedIn and check out his website, danschiebler.com. We'll definitely put all the links and resources from this episode into the show notes, which you can find at www.superdatascience.com/59. And if you enjoyed this podcast, then make sure to go to iTunes and leave us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate that to help spread the word about data science into the world. And I can't wait to see you next time. Until then, happy analyzing.